The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey there, happy Thursday. It is The Takeaway for September 8th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was a photo op on an aircraft carrier last night, but no one was saying mission accomplished, not at least until today, when Hillary Clinton, after her candidate forum on NBC News opposite Donald Trump, was practically crowing on the tarmac in White Plains, New York, about how much better she thought she looked than the Republican nominee.
What would Ronald Reagan say about a Republican nominee who attacks America's generals and heaps praise on Russia's president? I think we know the answer. And when asked how he would stop the spread of global terrorism, Trump's answer was simply, take the oil.
Among other things, Hillary Clinton referring to an apparent compliment Trump gave to Russian leader Putin during questioning last night by NBC's Matt Lauer. The Republican National Committee issued a statement criticizing Hillary Clinton's demeanor at the forum aboard the USS Intrepid aircraft carrier, a World War II-era ship, now a floating museum on the west side of Manhattan. The forum was organized by the group IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and in the audience were mostly veterans and uniformed military personnel. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins me now. It was a study in contrast, don't you think, Todd?
John, it was a study in how not to have a presidential forum, from the choice of the moderator to the time that was allotted. Voters, journalists, observers learned almost nothing of substance on what these two would-be commanders-in-chief would do to handle national security crisis, threats around the world, chronic and acute threats around the world. I can't paint a different picture for you, John, than to tell you it was awful. It was really awful. Now, Matt Lauer, the host of the Today Show, was chosen as the moderator. He spent about a third of Hillary Clinton's time on her emails. There were some questions on her emails and questions of whether voters can trust her because of the use of her email. One of the most interesting parts about this actually came from just before the forum started. Some news broke, released by House Democrats who are obviously trying to help Hillary Clinton. There has been a debate between Hillary Clinton and former Secretary of State Colin Powell about whether or not he used private emails in that job and whether he told her that, in fact, she should do the same. House Democrats, who have documents from email reviews pertaining to Hillary Clinton, released an email on January 23rd of 2009, 3 days after Hillary Clinton took office, in which Colin Powell specifically tells her that he uses a private phone line connected to a computer. He uses it in his office. He uses it on the road to communicate with world leaders, to communicate with other politicians, basically instructing her on how to use private email. Now, that's not a defense of Hillary Clinton, except it adds a much different fact to the narrative when Colin Powell says that Hillary Clinton right. was using private emails for
now,
over a year.
Now, that wasn't
that's not true.
That wasn't talked about last night, but we did get a pretty definitive statement from Hillary Clinton about the emails. What did you hear?
Well, Hillary Clinton was challenged on her emails, and she did give a little bit more of a specific explanation as to why this wasn't the national security threat that Republicans and some in the media have painted it out to be. She was also asked about the potential that this system could have been hacked even when she used it overseas. Listen.
Matt, there is no evidence. Of course, anything is possible. But what is factual is the State Department system was hacked. Most of the government systems are way behind the curve. We've had hacking repeatedly, even in the White House. There is no evidence my system was hacked.
Because she bought a better computer, perhaps. But that's something also that didn't come up. Hillary did seem to defy Matt Lauer's attempt to don't bash your opponent rule that was established right at the top of the forum. What did you think about that?
Yeah, they both candidates did that. That's to be expected because neither candidate is popular and they want to contrast with the shortcomings of the others. And with only 27 minutes per candidate on national security, you're just not going to get a great deal of substance, especially when they can't resist attacking one another. Now, Hillary Clinton pointed to Donald Trump's record criticizing her on things where he agreed. For instance, on his support for the war in Iraq. Here is Donald Trump saying that he was against the war in Iraq despite his criticisms of Hillary Clinton voting for authorization there.
I was against the war in Iraq because I said it's going to totally destabilize the Middle East, which it has. It has absolutely been a disastrous war. And by the way, perhaps almost as bad was the way Barack Obama got out. That was a disaster.
Of course, Trump told Howard Stern that he supported the war. And here's Hillary Clinton saying that Donald Trump supported her on Libya.
He's on record extensively supporting intervention in Libya when Gaddafi was threatening to massacre his population. I put together a coalition that included NATO, included the Arab League, and we were able to save lives. We did not lose a single American in that action.
But I think this comment from Donald Trump was mind-blowing. What do you think, Todd?
Under the leadership of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the generals have been reduced to rubble. They have been reduced to a point where it's embarrassing for our country. You have a force of 30,000 or so people, nobody really knows, but probably 30,000 people. And I can just see the great, as an example, General George Patton spinning in his grave as ISIS we can't beat.
John, it's a remarkable statement from somebody who wants to be commander-in-chief that the generals have been reduced to rubble, that he knows more than the generals about ISIS. Matt Lauer did try to pin Donald Trump down on his plan to defeat ISIS. He, again, said he's not going to telegraph that plan because it would tip his hand. Donald Trump's military plan also calls for generals to come back with him within 30 days on a plan to defeat ISIS. It's incoherent in the end. And in the end, this forum didn't shed any coherence on that plan at all. Debates start September 26th at Hofstra University in Long Island. And it's at that point where we hope that people who watched this debate and had the lessons learned from it will give voters a clearer picture of where the candidates stand.
And the other two headlines were the, you know, apparent a complimenting of Vladimir Putin and the tweet about why are women in the military if you don't want so much sexual harassment. All that stuff's going to be chewed over on Capitol Hill and everywhere else, don't you think?
All parts of Donald Trump's history and trying to retrofit the comments and off-the-cuff comments he's made so many times in his history into the role of commanding the U.S. military and intelligence service.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington Commander-in-Chief Correspondent. Thank you so much, Todd.
Sure, John.
Let's get a reaction now from retired Brigadier General Pete Dawkins, a veteran who served for 24 years in the U.S. Army. He's a graduate of West Point, a Heisman Trophy winner, Rhodes Scholar, and a former Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. So while he hardly speaks for everyone in the military, he's a live data point for us today. General Dawkins, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
Is it appropriate for it appears as though uniformed personnel in the United States are judging the civilian leadership? Isn't that supposed to be separate? We don't necessarily elect who our generals say is the best person to lead us, right?
Well, there's a wonderful tradition in the American military of being responsive to and subservient to the political leadership. And I think one of the things that's distinctive about the military culture in our country, as composed with a lot of others, is that they, I think, have remained true to that sense of responsibility.
In a command situation, does the tone of Donald Trump, I did this, I did that, well, I meant that, but I didn't really do that, you know, the kinds of back and forth and off the top of his head tone, does that concern you at all in a situation room kind of scene?
You know, one of the interesting things was when Matt Lauer asked about at the beginning, why are they qualified to be commander-in-chief to each, to Secretary Clinton and to Mr. Trump? Secretary Clinton emphasized, you know, temperament and judgment and steadiness and how complicated many of the decisions that the president as commander-in-chief would have to make. And Mr. Trump said, I've got great experience internationally, and I have a good judgment, and didn't really nail that point, I didn't feel.
Yeah, he's been around the world, but, you know, you wonder what he would do in that situation room. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton represents a political elite in the United States, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, that the U.S. military has reason to mistrust for a whole lot of reasons, given the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war and the kinds of policy decisions that have been made, the penalties for which have been borne by the U.S. military in terms of casualties and missions that in certain cases were hopeless. How do you think she did representing that political elite?
Well, I think she made the point that in retrospect, she felt the war in Iraq was a mistake and was challenged by Matt Lauer on that and stuck, you know, firmly to that position. I was a little surprised when she said she would never send U.S. troops ever again to Iraq because we have U.S. troops in Iraq. Mr. Trump said he was totally against the war in Iraq when it certainly appears as though his stance for quite a while has been that he was not against the war in Iraq. When asked what should have been done that would have led to a better outcome, he said we should have taken the oil, which, from what I've been able to understand, was going to be a very difficult stance to take, since many people who are critics of our involvement were presupposing that the reason we went into Iraq was to take their oil, control their oil reserves, which are, of course, massive.
And, of course, I mean, the idea of just taking the oil, occupying Basra in the south and creating a military fortress in southern Iraq, just seems to be kind of Star Trek fantasy, if you ask me. But I, you know, I don't know about that. Does that cause you to grimace a little bit as a general if you were asked to do something like that?
Well, not so much as a general, but I must say I question the wisdom of doing that. I suppose it would have been feasible to have built fortresses around the oil facilities and whatnot, but I think even that would have been very difficult to do.
Well, General, we're out of time. Let me ask you before we go. You're the Heisman Trophy winner. Who would you rather receive a downfield forward pass from, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump at this point?
I'm going to punt on that, if I can use the football analogy. I believe that the upcoming debates are going to be very instrumental, not just people in uniform or veterans, but in all Americans, to make a judgment. We're coming down to a point where a decision is going to be made.
You're permitted to punt. I suspect Hillary Clinton would have a better spy role than Donald Trump.
It would be a very interesting game.
Yeah, there you go.
Let me put it that way.
There you go. Retired General Pete Dawkins won't bite at that one, and he's a smart man. Edwards, Colorado is where he spoke to us from. Pete Dawkins, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Work began this week on what's being called the Great Wall of Calais, a 13-foot, $2.5 million wall that will run for about 0.6 miles in Calais, France, designed to keep migrants living in camps there from crossing over into the UK. It's the latest in a series of construction projects along borders throughout Europe. There's a new wall in Hungary, barbed wire fences in Greece, a new barrier set to be built in Austria. In the Middle East, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said earlier in the year of his already well-walled country that he wants to, quote, surround all of Israel with some kind of fence. Someday will a Great Wall of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico be visible from space along with China's Great Wall? Joining me is Commissioner David Aguilar, former Deputy Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection between 2010 and 2013, as well as former Chief of U.S. Border Patrol between 2004 and 2010. He's currently a partner at Global Security Innovative Strategies.
These are tools to be used as part of an enforcement system, whether this was centuries ago or presently today. They are but one aspect of an enforcement system that has to be applied. The wall in and of itself will not stop the crossings of people, as I said, narcotics, or anything of that nature coming into a country. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the case of the United States, our southern border with Mexico, simple things were used to overcome. Narcotics used to be catapulted, are still being catapulted, across our 18-foot walls. There are ultralights flying above the 18-foot wall and below our radars that are actually applied on our southern border. There are tunnels being built. So, again, it creates that persistent deterrence that assists in creating the density of enforcement effort, but in and of themselves, by themselves, they are not a silver bullet.
How do you deal with the balance of what the perception of a wall is in terms of making people feel better versus what they actually do in maintaining this deterrence? Listen to what Elizabeth Vallet, who's the author of a book, Borders, Fences, and Walls, said on our program about a year ago.
If you try to prevent people from coming in, if you're trying to achieve a security, a sovereignty, aim, no, they do not work. But if you consider border walls, border fences as a public relation operation led by a government which is trying to show his population that he's trying to do something, then they do work. They work as a symbol of a political goal.
Expensive for a political goal or cheap?
Well, I think that absolutely walls are going to be very expensive, but they are also tremendous assets applied correctly. Yes, the political rhetoric that's going on here in the United States right now concerning walls is concerning. And the reason for that is because we're talking as a country, the politicians are talking about walls 2,000 miles long along the entirety of the border with Mexico. Well, that's ludicrous. That is not necessary. It would be a tremendous waste of treasure, if you will. And it would not help the situation as it relates to control of our and managing our borders. The peak year for illegal immigration and narcotics trafficking in this country was year 2000. 2000, we had over 1.6 million people that we apprehended coming into the United States illegally. Fast forward to where we are today. And by the way, back then, the 650-some miles of wall did not exist. Fast forward to where we are today, the apprehensions have fallen by over 80 to 82%. This year, the Border Patrol will end up the fiscal year with approximately 380,000 apprehensions along the southwest border of Mexico. And by the way, these are apprehensions that we know more of. In other words, back in 2000, we had no idea what was getting away. Today, the Border Patrol approximates that up to 80 to 85% of what is crossing the border illegally is being apprehended.
And that success is a result of all kinds of things, not just that amount of wall that you said has been built since 2000.
Absolutely. But where the wall was built as a part of the enforcement system, it was absolutely critical that that wall be placed and built in the fashion, form and fashion that it was. Now, the 652 miles that were built in 2006 to 2008 under the Bush administration, that was designed. I was the chief of the Border Patrol at that time. That was designed by the chiefs in the field to address what was needed at that time.
Does the political system serve well the people of the United States, given that there seems to be an incentive to over-dramatize fear as a way of getting people's attention and then getting their votes? And then one is left with the impression that, in fact, politicians have an interest in keeping people completely in the dark about what their real security and real fear is. You've been doing this for 35 years. What's your feeling?
Well, I'll tell you, one, it was very frustrating because when you hear rhetoric like what is going on today in the political arena relating to, you use the word fear. I couch it more as addressing the peak interests of the American population, the border. I use the term or the number of people that are going to be apprehended this year crossing the southern border with Mexico, about 380,000, which is a lot, still a lot more to be done. But overstays, people coming into the United States, flying into the United States, overstaying their visas last year was right at 500,000. That is seldom talked about. So we're talking about spending multi-billions, that's with a B, billions of dollars on building walls when that what we should be talking about is what should we do about the real problems as it relates to illegal immigration, smuggling, human trafficking, narcotics, and things of that nature. Take a look at that number. More people overstaying their visas, therefore illegally in the United States, that actually fly in here legally and then become illegal once they're here because they don't leave.
David Aguilar is a former Deputy Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, former Chief of U.S. Border Patrol, and currently a partner at Global Security Innovative Strategies. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
In the Uber game, who wins? Is it you who feels like you get the ride quicker than standing on a corner? Or is it Uber who sets the price and when it surges, you have to decide how much this Uber business is worth to you? For instance, are you one of these kind of people? I'm in a hurry. Go for it. Hey, thanks. 89th in Amsterdam, please. Or are you one of these kind of people? Oh, for heaven's sakes, that's highway robbery. Forget you, Uber. What's a little rain, anyway? The who wins in the Uber game is actually a sophisticated question of economics. And the Uber service allows economists to examine for the very first time how consumers respond to price changes in real time. In a new paper out this week, a team of economists looked at data from over 54 million user sessions from four cities, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York, from the first half of 2015. How many people are requesting cars, at what price points, and when users decide the price has gone too high. A gold mine. Steve Levitt, Freakonomics co-author and economist at the University of Chicago, was a co-author of the paper. He passed along the findings to Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio. And Dubner says while the perception of surge pricing may make people feel like losers, the data shows something else, something radically different, in fact.
There are some essential truths in economics that the more you talk to economists, you find out are more a little more truthy than truthful. In other words, they're kind of theoretical representations of the way the world works as opposed to measured representations. And one of those very foundational ideas is what's called the demand curve. So if you've ever taken Econ 101, you've seen that demand curve that someone will get up and draw on the board, usually the first day of class, and it shows you, you know, as price rises, demand for most goods will fall and so on. And then there are obviously different permutations of that. The problem is measuring a demand curve in the real world is hard to do. Why? Because the way prices work, you don't change prices on things all the time. In most cases, you go into the store and apples cost what they cost. And so what you want to know is exactly how much demand there is for things at a given price. And then at a given price plus, let's say, 1%, plus 2%, plus 10%. And that's the kind of thing you can get at with the Uber data, thanks to what they have, which is called surge pricing.
Okay, so I take public transit. I pay one price. I don't want it rising when it's rush hour, although there will be a rush hour fee that I'll pay. That's fine. When it starts raining, I don't want to pay a higher fee. Uber surge pricing is gouging when the rain opens up and you start getting poured on.
Says the person who's read a lot of communist manifestos, I would say. So,
come on.
So, well, you know, surge pricing, from an economic standpoint at least, means that you have a better way to let demand and supply meet where they want. So, you know, here's the famous example. You know, where most of the anti-price gouging laws come into play have to do with if there's a storm coming or something, right? And if there's a storm, what happens? A lot of people go to the Lowe's or the Home Depot or whatever, and they buy all the flashlights, all the batteries, all the bottled water. So that the next people that come, well, they were willing to pay. Maybe they were willing to pay double, but there is none left. Why? Because all those people kind of overbought. So that's what happens when you've got a static price. The idea of something like Uber or many other realms in which there's dynamic pricing. I mean, in some realms, we call it dynamic pricing, the airlines, hotels, and so on. And we're used to it in those realms. We're not used to it in other realms. And so what Uber does with surge pricing is, yes, allows the demand to meet the supply where it wants to. And you may dislike that a lot. If you want a ride, however, you have a choice. You can either stand where you are for longer to wait and pay the same, a taxi or a bus or whatever, or you can stand for shorter time and pay more. But getting away from the morality or the practicalities even of surge pricing, what surge pricing does in a database is allows for an economist to look at, yes, as you said, exactly how consumers make purchasing decisions in a way that is way more empirical, way more quantifiable than just about anything that economists have come up with before.
So what did the data show? That consumers were paying more than they needed to, or Uber was benefiting inappropriately? How do you evaluate this data?
Quite the opposite. What Levitt was using these Uber data to try to measure was what economists call consumer surplus. And consumer surplus generally is the difference between what you would be willing to pay for something and what you actually pay. And it turns out that in a given year in the U.S. alone, the consumer surplus produced by Uber is in the neighborhood of $7 billion with a B dollars, John.
Consumer surplus is one of the most important things in economics. It's one of the incredible beauties of the market system is that for so much of what we buy, we would have been willing to pay way more for it than we actually have to.
And so Uber's argument there, according to Steve Levitt, is that, in fact, Uber could have gotten a lot more money with its surge pricing system, and that far from gouging people, it's actually taken a hit.
You know, it's one of the trickiest things that any firm, not even firms, individuals, if you're selling your home, it's one of the trickiest things that you have to do, which is set a price, right? And so one thing that the digital world allows us to do is adjust. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, including you, John Hockenberry, sound leery of that kind of adjustment because it feels unfair. But the fact is, if producers and consumers can take advantage of digital technology to let the market make itself more kind of robustly, more tightly, yeah, there will be opportunities for consumers. And right now, even though you might dislike Uber, you'd still have to recognize that they're providing a service that a lot of people are using and would willingly pay more for.
Does this data say that Uber should raise its prices and should start doing that immediately to tell its shareholders, yeah, we're going to get rid of this consumer surplus?
Well, that's a really good and kind of nuanced question. So it's really hard for me to say yes or no. Could they bring in more money? Almost certainly yes. Would that be the, quote, right thing to do? Well, you know, one could argue that providing consumers with a big surplus is a wonderful thing to do on many dimensions. Will Uber eventually have to raise prices in order to close the gap because they did lose a bunch of money the last 6 months? Look, I don't know. I don't know if anybody really can profess to know. One thing that's interesting to note, however, is this consumer surplus is large now, even when you're paying a bunch of human drivers. One thing to think about is Uber, among many others, is moving as fast as it can toward an autonomous car future. So you can imagine that even though that technology will be more costly up front, eliminating drivers potentially creates even more consumer surplus from a service like Uber. It may end up years from now, maybe not so many years from now, that it costs you less to get to the grocery store than to even buy that first apple. That's kind of the direction we're moving in.
Stephen Dubner is host of Freakonomics Radio, the latest episode all about Uber and the surge pricing model. And this data is out today. You can find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Stephen Dubner, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, a rising conservative rock star and Trump supporter, has been under fire for taking a $25,000 campaign contribution days before the Orlando Sentinel newspaper reported Bondi was considering joining the New York Attorney General in suing Trump University or the Trump Institute. The decision was made not to pursue the lawsuit, but both Trump and Bondi denied the donation had anything to do with that lawsuit. Trump later paid a $2,500 tax penalty for the gift. But was this an improper attempt to manipulate a possible court case? Veteran Florida politician Bill McCollum was attorney general in Florida before Pam Bondi. Bill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be with you.
So when, to your best of your recollection, were you made aware of any complaints against Trump Enterprises, Educational Enterprises, the Institute, or the university?
I read an article in the Orlando Sentinel long after I left office when it was discussing, I think Maxwell, a columnist, was discussing the issue of Bondi and the question of complaints against Trump Institute or Trump University.
So during your tenure, you never saw any complaints, even though the Sentinel says and Bondi says that most of the complaints came in during your tenure.
None of those complaints were brought to my attention during the time I was there, which makes me think there were not that many of them, because normally they would have been had there been a sufficient number.
Now, just I don't know how many there were or what number there is, and you don't recall and all of that. But, you know, Trump is a big real estate investor in the state of Florida and a huge name in the state of Florida. Isn't it odd that complaints against someone as huge as Trump wouldn't make it to your desk?
Well, not necessarily, because if there were not enough numbers and there was no reason for it to come to my desk, then it didn't come. We actually opened investigations on several private colleges while I was Attorney General because there were complaints and because there were issues that we felt were there, but nothing related to the Trump Institute or Trump University.
All right. So since you've observed the reports of what Pam Bondi, Attorney General, now accepted in the state of Florida as a donation from a Trump foundation, and what she subsequently did in terms of her actions regarding responding to complaints about Trump University, do you think Pam Bondi made an error in judgment?
I don't know. I don't know enough to be able to tell you that.
Would you have done the same thing? You received $25,000 and agree to drop decision to join a lawsuit?
Well, I think you're making an assumption, John, that Pam Bondi agreed to drop something in return for receiving a contribution. And I think that's a huge leap here. We don't know enough to know that.
Well,
I don't know.
$25,000 one day, then after that, no lawsuit. I mean, and this is the presidential candidate we're talking about, not just anybody.
Well, I realize that, and so there is an appearance of impropriety. I would grant you that.
All right. So since you're aware of the appearance, you're an experienced politician. Is this the kind of thing you're going to put your foot in, as an experienced politician in Florida?
Well, first of all, Trump Institute was licensed to use the Trump name, but had no other direct affiliation with Donald Trump or the Trump University. So my understanding also is that at the time that all of this arose in the Bondi administration, Trump Institute was going through a huge financial difficulty. And I suspect that they did not have a very good reason to go after Trump Institute at that point for the complaints that they received, simply because there was no money there to recover for those who were the victims. But I'm not there. I wasn't there. I don't know that.
Former Attorney General of Florida, Bill McCollum, thank you so much for being a part of the program.
You're welcome.
Can you hear the megaphones of the fashion police encouraging you to get with your back-to-school wardrobe? Here's the new fall collection. Don't wear last year's spring and summer hits. It all kind of makes you think you're supposed to throw out your wardrobe every few hours. But who can afford that? Nevertheless, the message in the fashion retail world seems to be, if it's old, throw it out. Not quite right, just ditch it. And that echoes a practice in the making of apparel. Consumers throw away about 85% of all the clothes we buy. Brands toss huge amounts of fabric as waste. Finished clothes still on the racks at discounter Century 21 can just end up in a dumpster as textile waste. And that's a growing part of our country's landfills. As Fashion Week gets underway here in New York, we spoke with Tracy Kinden, founder of Revolve Waste, a consulting group that works with different brands and organizations to reduce textile waste.
There have been a few interesting things happening over the last 20 years. You know, as the apparel industry began manufacturing more and more in Asia, the U.S. consumption rate of apparel has increased really, really drastically. And so what that means is that the waste problem has increased very drastically. As we consume more, we take more natural resources out of the planet, and those wind up in landfill. And the reality is the rate of consumption is going to outpace the ability for resources to be available. And so in order to create what's being called now a circular apparel industry for the future, we've got to do something other than throw that stuff away.
Now, it seems to me, first of all, that textiles and fabrics are much closer to the earth than plastic and glass bottles. Is that not the case? I mean, linen is comes from a plant. So does cotton. If you throw them away, how does it not sort of naturally recycle in some way?
Those items do decompose. The items that come from what you mentioned, linens and cotton-based fibers, certainly decompose. The thing that most people don't know, two things actually. One is that there is a growing percentage of synthetic fibers in the market, specifically polyester. And of course, we love our spandex in the U.S., so that is a fiber that's increasing in presence. So those items don't decompose. Those fibers don't decompose. That's a problem. The other thing is that textiles have so much chemistry that goes into them, from dyes and processing chemistry, finishing chemistry. And so it's really not a good thing to put those chemicals back into the earth. It can get into water systems. It's not a good thing.
So how do we change the process to recognize and reduce this fashion waste? And how much more consumer awareness does there need to be to have an impact on this waste stream?
I tell brands this a lot. Brands have an incredibly powerful mouthpiece to spread the message of reclaiming resources. So changing the mind of the consumer needs to come from the brands themselves talking more about recovering those resources that they've put into their garments. It also can come from policy, but consumers need to be more aware of what they're doing. Garments aren't disposable. They're not truly a consumable like food is.
And what does that mean in terms of changing the way things are made or the things that clothes are made with?
That's a great question. In fact, one very close to my heart. I am a geek inside, and I love the new technologies that are developing to actually take old garments and make them into new ones. That prospect of taking old garments apart and literally reassembling new yarns and new fibers, new textiles, is in the future. In the meantime, I think reuse is a really important part of the system, being able to use something over and over and over, and creating an infrastructure with that reuse system to then claim those materials, reclaim those materials at the end of a reuse cycle and put them into this developing technology that will literally take apart those items fiber by fiber and create brand new high-quality textiles.
Tracy Kinden is the founder of Revolve Waste. She spoke to us from Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
These are sort of good times for people with bad, embarrassing handwriting. With everything printed or typed and spell-checked, when was the last time you put that sailboat-looking flourish on a handwritten cursive S?
Hi, I'm Mike Schutz from West Grove, Pennsylvania, and I have not written cursive since college back in the 1970s. I stopped doing it because my handwriting was horrible, so I went to printing everything, and it's been so long since I've written cursive that if I try to write anything other than my signature, my hand just will not do that. It will not go in those directions. So unfortunately, I can't even fake my wife's written name.
Hi, this is Clay from Foxborough, Massachusetts. I still make a point to write notes, but I can tell that from my own experience that my writing skills have diminished a bit, and I see that the craft of penmanship has slipped. It's really sad because we lose the sentiment of a note. I love you in a text or an email is not the same as I love you in a handwritten note.
Author Anne Trubeck has examined closely the impact of handwriting on society. In her new book, The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting, Trubeck says the digital revolution is both launching us toward a no-handwriting future and also sending us backward in time to when the spoken word ruled.
Well, handwriting certainly has been around for about 6,000 years. It's actually pretty recent in terms of how long humanity has been around. Calligraphy in the West is actually pretty new. It was a sort of an invention of the machine age. So when you have, you know, the sort of move to industry in response, you have sort of William Morris and the arts and crafts movement, and the calligraphy movement in the West grows out of that sense that things were becoming more standardized and generic.
And there's always been a tradition of elaborate celebration of handwriting in the Muslim world with the Qurans and the way in which Arabic is both learned, spoken, and written.
Absolutely. And that's also true of Hebrew and Judaism, where the actual writing of the holy text is very important and very central to the religion. And writing is a spiritual act.
So given all those competing traditions that are all very worthy and the practicalities of 21st century life, where does a question like, should kids learn handwriting or cursive handwriting, how does that question get resolved?
I don't think kids should be assessed on their ability to master cursive. It's not going to be something they're going to use much in their lives as they grow older. It's not something most of us adults use in our lives today. That isn't to say that kids shouldn't do it if they want to, and schools might, you know, want to offer it in arts or an elective, but to grade kids on their ability to do the loop on the G the correct way, when that's not something it will be pertinent to their lives, doesn't seem to make sense.
Although there is a joy in seeing a child create a sentence with their own hands, both for a parent and a teacher and the child, that you just can't duplicate in, you know, typing or printing out a document from a computer.
I would say, one, there's also a lot of pain when a child can't write that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And two, what's most important for me, I think, in education is good writing, is to focus on how to teach children how to express their ideas, how to organize their thoughts, how to make arguments, you know, the content of the writing. The forming of the letters is less important. And there are certainly many ways to individualize what you write beyond having, you know, the way you circle the I, you know, or cross your T.
And in fact, there are many writers today who operate exclusively with vocal interfaces.
That's right.
And these are, you know, people who are well-educated, who don't have problems with handwriting, but who prefer now to dictate.
Sure.
To computers. Novelist Richard Powers is a good example, and there are others.
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, all writing is artificial. You need a technology for any kind of writing. A pencil is a technology. Speaking is the most natural form of communicating. And so voice recognition software, in some ways, is the least mediated form of writing you can do. Socrates, you know, valued orality, and he was very down on writing. He thought, you know, sort of if culture started to do more writing, we would forget things, it would be less complex. And many of the great authors and figures throughout history have either dictated to scribes. Caesar would have 7 scribes running around behind him as he walked through the Roman Colosseum. Henry James would dictate to a secretary who typed all of his writing because he loved the sound of the typewriter. He loved dictating, and that's what worked for him.
And if you read carefully, Plato, who was very suspicious of reading culture in the ways in which it would damage memory, would Plato have preferred to have just waited until oral software came around? Would have preferred to just bypass writing altogether?
Sure, except the only reason that we know this, we know his thoughts and Socrates' thoughts, is because Plato wrote them down.
Mm.
But absolutely, people living in an oral culture, completely oral culture, have much more capacious memories than those of us who are literate and live in literate cultures. I mean, just imagine if you could never look anything up, how much more you retain in your head if you knew you could never just go look it up later.
I'll tell you a story of something that kind of represents the whole cycle here. My poor daughter, first day of classes in college, didn't have a government ID and needed her passport FedExed to her so she could get her work-study job. I tossed the passport in a FedEx envelope did all the digital online shipping stuff that you do. But I couldn't just send it off without tossing in a little note that say, I love you, I love you, I love you. And it sends off. She gets it. And I get a picture on my smartphone of the note that I sent to her with just a huge number of hearts, which underscores the value of handwriting right there. I mean, she was so pleased to receive my dreadful handwriting.
Absolutely. I mean, for us today, 21st century America, handwriting represents something individual and unique about a person. It hasn't always meant that in previous times in history, and it won't always mean that in the future. But right now for us, we relate our sense of self to our handwriting.
But let's admit it, it's going away, right?
Slowly, but yeah. A lot of people, you know, are very adamant about the importance of it, but at the same time will admit that they never handwrite themselves.
Anne Trubeck is author of The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Imagine a candidate, Gary Johnson, who couldn't find this on a map of Syria.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About?
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Aleppo is in Syria. It's the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Okay, got it. Got it.
Wow, MSNBC made plenty of news out of that. But Hillary Clinton had a response at a news conference.
Well, you could look on the map and find Aleppo.
At a Libertarian convention a few months back, while talking to reporters about diversity, Gary Johnson was told by an aide that his meeting was going to be in the Harriet Tubman conference room. His response, who's Harriet Tubman? The New Yorker said the aide reminded him who Tubman was. Johnson recalled, oh, she will appear on a new $20 bill, perhaps the least significant thing to know about Harriet Tubman. In fact, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.